You're listening to audio from Southwestern Baptist Theological Seminary, where we train students to preach the Word and reach the world. For more free resources like this one, visit www.swbts.edu/media-resources.
Well, I'm delighted to be here this morning, and I appreciate this privilege. It's always a tremendous blessing for me to be back at my alma mater. And I have said before that on more occasions than ever you would dream, I found myself located in the men's room just down the hall before a test, saying, as I looked in the mirror, "Dear God, if you will let me pass this test, I will never sin again." He never took me up on that, by the way, and I doubt he's going to take you up on that. Nothing beats good preparation, does it? Well, a little luck wouldn't hurt, and does not substitute, however, for preparation. We were seated at the breakfast table this morning with Orville Rogers, a good friend of ours and a great friend of this school's and of missions and former missionary, and then Mrs. Patterson, and of course she was reminding me that when you're in the pulpit, it's imperative that you take some cheap shots at Paige. That's not exactly the way she said it. I said, "Do you mind if I tease Dr. Patterson mercilessly?" She said, "If you don't, you'll be the first person who ever graced that pulpit who didn't." But I'm going to resist that effort. I bring some bad news, and that is that Cabela's and Bass Pro asked me to tell you to pass along to your husband that the lease is up on those animal mounts that he has gotten from them. And when he's tired of playing with them, would he please bring them back? I mean, you'd think it's enough that the Dead Sea Scrolls are dead, but no, we've got to, anyway. It is a delight to be here, and I'm blessed, and I'm humbled, and my wife Jeannie is with me here, and she loves being in chapel, partly because she gets to see a couple of our grandsons who are here, and four nephews, one of whom graces the platform. Well, I don't know if graces is the right word, but one of whom is seated up here at the platform, and a couple of others who are in the graduate school, and then another one who's working on his PhD here. And this is sort of a family thing. We love Southwestern Seminary, and I want you to know that. You are most blessed. You have no idea what a privilege this is, that you have the privilege of sharing in this educational experience during these days. Some time ago, I received a request from a sister seminary to write an article for one of their publications on the subject of time, T-I-M-E, time. Now, that was an interesting study for me as I prepared my heart to write. Time, you know, is a creation of God. It is, of course, as all of God's creations, made for your benefit, but also for His glory. We measure time by things that are created, right? Even while we're seated here today, the earth continues inexorably spinning on its axis and revolving around the sun. Some of you have watches that, of course, employ the use of a little quartz crystal, the atomic tick in that quartz crystal, but we measure time with created things. Time is a resource. God is beyond time, of course. We speak of God as being eternal. That's hard for us to fathom, but the Creator is larger than that which was created. And if you were born in this room, for instance, and grew up in this room, never got outside this room, someone could come in and tell you about the sun and the moon and the stars, and they'd do their dead level best, but you'd scratch your head and say, "I'm trying to conceive of that." Now, the fact that you had difficulty conceiving of that does not mean that it doesn't exist. That is, that there's not a sun or a moon or a stars. It just means it's outside your frame of reference. Well, when God created this universe, part of creation was time. And of course, God is beyond that. He is eternal. And that's why everything that we know about has a beginning and an end, has a start and a finish, a birth and a death. That's why we're reminded in the Scriptures that this body that we have is like a suit of clothes. One of these days, it's going to disintegrate. And all that will be left of us will be that which is eternal of us. And where we spend our eternal destiny will be determined by decisions we made during this time on earth. Time is a resource. You ever thought about that? It's a resource that God places into your hands. And like every other resource God places in your hands, He expects, especially of His children, that you be a good steward of it. One of these days, you will answer to God for the way in which you have spent this time. You will be there at the judgment seat of Christ, and the issue won't be whether you're going to spend your eternity in heaven. You wouldn't be there unless you were going to spend your eternity in heaven. But the issue will be, what did you do with what I gave you? And in this instance, what did you do with your time? Now, because time is a part of this created order, and because we, the managers of time, are in this created order, time and those of us who live in it have fallen under the curse of sin. Now, what that means is that time, unless we have other redemptive plans for it, is not going to just naturally run to the good, it's going to naturally run to the evil. You can't just get up in the morning and fall out of bed and expect that everything's going to go well for you that day. The Apostle Paul, in fact, reminds us of this when he uses one of the unusual words for time. Not chronos, not the ticking of the seconds, but the kairos. He said we ought to make the most or redeem the time. Make the most of it, because this day, he said, is an evil day that we live in. So we are to redeem the time. We're to have better plans for our time than the devil. And by the way, the devil has plenty of plans for your time. And he already has mounted a multi-billion-dollar program to capture your time and to use it for evil purposes. But you have to buy it back. You have to make better plans for it. You have to redeem it. Now, while I was conducting this study just to get my heart ready to write, well, I had a dream. Now, Jeannie will tell you that I don't have a lot of dreams. And when I do, and if they're memorable, I always tell her. So I woke her up to tell her this dream. Now, I'm doing that to add a little credibility to what I'm saying here, because it's going to sound astounding. Preachers ought not to have to say, now, this is true. But this is true. So I woke her up, and I told her about my dream. In my dream, I was transported back to where we used to live in Zimbabwe, Africa. I was seated on a gombe, a rock outcropping, and I was looking over a vast water pan, one of those National Geographic scenes that has all of those wild animals in it. And every animal was there. I mean, from the elephant right on down to the smallest, the little duiker, everything was out there. I mean, and the more I looked at this, the more I realized these weren't animals. This was time. I mean, I know this sounds crazy. It must have been the pizza, but this was time, all the way from elephant years down to kudu months down to impala weeks. I mean, even the gnats that were buzzing by were little seconds and milliseconds as they came by me. And I noticed in this scene that all of this time was represented by these animals was moving to my left and down toward a gate, and I looked way off, and there was a man standing way down at the end who had the gate open, and my time was filtering out through that gate. So this was my time. I didn't want him to do that, so I got off the rock, and I walked down there, and the closer I got, this was my dream. The closer I got to him, the more I realized this was not just any man. This was the adversary. This was, you know, a representation of Satan himself. I mean, he had on a cowboy hat. He had his boot up on one of the rails of the gate. He had a weed in his mouth and sort of a laconic grin on his face. And when I got closer to him, I said, "Hey, what are you doing?" He said, I'm letting this time out this gate." And I said, "But you can't. That's my time." And he responded, "But you don't have any plans for it." And it was at that moment that I woke up. So we're going to think about time this morning and the use of our time. And I confess to you, I am speaking on this subject because I could wish that someone had spoken to my heart about it when I was seated right where you are. I want to read to you from the 90th Psalm. This is a Psalm of Moses, which is very interesting because he writes about some age spans which he exceeded. Moses, as you call, lived to be 120. Let me just read to you, beginning with verse 1. Lord, you've been our dwelling place in all generations. Before the mountains were born, or you gave birth to the earth and the world, even from everlasting to everlasting, you are God. You turn man back into dust, and you say, return, O children of men. For 1,000 years in your sight are like yesterday when it passes by, or as a watch in the night. You've swept them away like a flood. They sleep. In the morning, they're like grass which sprouts anew. And in the morning, it flourishes and sprouts anew. And toward evening, it fades and withers away. For we've been consumed by your anger. Here is the result of what we can expect if we use time incorrectly. We've been consumed by your anger, and by your wrath we've been dismayed. You have placed our iniquities before you, our secret sins in the light of your presence. For all our days have declined in your fury. We have finished our years like a sigh. As for the days of our life, they contain 70 years, or if due to strength, 80 years. Yet in their pride is but labor and sorrow, for soon it is gone and we fly away. You know the gospel song. Who understands the power of your anger and your fury? According to the fear that is due you. So, teach us to number our days that we may present to you a heart of wisdom. Do return, O Lord. How long will it be and be sorry for your servants? O satisfy us in the morning with your loving kindness that we may sing for joy and be glad all our days. Make us glad according to the days you've afflicted us and the years we have seen evil. Let your work appear to your servants and your majesty to their children. Let the favor of God be upon us. And I like the marginal reading here for the word confirm. Give permanence to the work of our hands. Yes, give permanence to the work of our hands. Let something result from our brief time on this earth that has eternal impact. Time. Go back with me, if you will, please, to verse 12. So teach us to number our days that we may apply our hearts to wisdom. Now, the question, this begs the question, what does it mean to number our days? Surely it must mean something more than counting them off, 1, 2, 3, 4, or we have 30 days in 1 month, and 38, and then there's leap year, and there's 28, or rather 31, and then there's 28. It certainly must mean something more than that. And it does. It means that we should consider that each day has value. The picture here is like a piece of black velvet upon which a jeweler puts diamonds and he begins to count them out one at a time. Maybe I can illustrate it this way. And I use this illustration because this just occurred last night. Down in the bowels of Fort Worth here, a place I never would have expected to have found myself at that hour, but I was called by the butler of a very, very wealthy man here in Fort Worth. He is an orthopedic surgeon, and I received the phone call that he would like to meet with me. As you know, you're the president of the International Mission Board. Could I meet with you? And so I took a cab, and I went down. In fact, I was a little fearful of this. I thought, is this a hoax? This is the kind of thing Dr. Patterson would do to me. So I went down into downtown Fort Worth, where I would never expect a person to have a dwelling. But there's some old apartment buildings there. And much to my surprise, he actually had bought several units and gutted them. And I was met at the door by the butler who took me upstairs to where this physician was. He's infirm now. In fact, he's bedfast. And he introduced himself to me. Jeannie said, she's a little bit worried about me using this illustration, but I'll be careful, honey. And so he said that he, for years, had had this great appreciation for the International Mission Board and for mission work in general, and he wanted to give me a gift. And you can imagine, you know, I'm trying to process all of this, but it was very genuine and not a dream. I said, well, you know, I'd be very happy to receive that on behalf of the International Mission Board. And he asked me to go over to a roll-top desk underneath a window there in his bedroom. And he said, pull out the center drawer. And I did. And in that drawer, there was a little box, sort of like the box that silverware comes in that you ladies, you know, you may know about, that thick and about this wide. And he said, bring that over here beside my bed. So I brought it over to his bedside. And he said, sit right down right there. And he said, now open it up. Now, I did. And I need to be careful here, okay? I did. And inside that box, he said, there are 50 sacks. He said, I want you to count them. And I did. I counted them out, 50 sacks. He said, now in each of these sacks, he said, I want to give them to you. I'm going to do this, honey. He said, in each of these sacks, there are 40 uncut diamonds. And I want to show you here. These are, can you see those? These are uncut diamonds. He said, each of those diamonds, I'm computing 40 times 50. Okay. He said, each of these diamonds in its uncut form is worth about $3,000. He said, now, anywhere from $3,000 to $7,000. He said, now, and so I'm doing the math. Okay, it's immediately that $6 million that I am holding. I'm serious. Jeannie was afraid that I would... Oh, excuse me. Don't move. Don't move. Just no, hon, don't touch it. I can see it. I can see it. Don't move. And so he said, I can see you too. What is his name? All right, each of these diamonds, he said, I've made it my life's hobby to collect these diamonds. And he said, I want to give them all to you. He said, downstairs, he said, I have an array of machinery. He said, it's a CAD machine. You put the diamond on it. It turns it. He explained about choo-choos, little smoky things in the diamond. And he said, it will turn them, and it'll strike a mark on them. And when it does, you can cut it. He said, the machine will do the cutting, or you can give it to a professional. And he said, this increases the value to anywhere from $13,000 to $27,000. So I couldn't believe that I was... wait a minute, just a second. Actually, I just bought those at Hobby Lobby. Actually, I didn't meet a physician downtown. I just made that story up. But every day God has given you is worth more than a diamond. And God is going to hold you and me accountable for the way we use every one of these days He entrusts to us. We are to count them out as valuable. We're to realize that our days are numbered. If you read Psalm 139, you'll know that He has ordained certain days before for you before you were ever born. And in one sense, physicians cannot extend your life. They can just help you to be comfortable on the journey. Because God has ordained the days that you and I live. And He says, I want you to have value for these. Now, why would God want us to count out our days in this fashion, to number them in this fashion? He says, I have a purpose in that. It's so that you might present to me... the word literally, I think you're aware of this, means go out and bring back as a gift to me, what? A heart of wisdom. Now, you know, when we think about wisdom, that is an inexhaustible subject. We don't want to go there. You know that knowledge is the accumulation of facts, and wisdom is just knowing how to use them to the glory of God and to the benefit of man. But we do know this, that the beginning of wisdom, the very starting place for wisdom, kindergarten for wisdom, involves what? It involves the fear of the Lord. That's what the Scripture says. For the fear of the Lord is the starting place for wisdom. Now, a lot can be said about the fear of the Lord. I mean, a good, healthy, God-fearing spirit would not hurt any of us. If you are inclined to surf the internet, or if you're inclined to just, you know, to take a glance or let your heart go in the wrong directions there, why don't you just get a little yellow sticky note and write on it, "I have no fear of God," and put it on the screen of your computer. Because the ways of the Lord are before the eye. The ways of man are before the eyes of the Lord. He ponders all his going. The eyes of the Lord are in every place, beholding the good and evil. And if it would make your heart leap up into your throat, if you're married and your wife walked in and saw you seeing that, gentlemen, God is already there. One more important than your wife is already there. But I'm not talking about that kind of fear. Wouldn't hurt. We're to have it. But in general, the fear of the Lord is to have such a big idea of who God is that you just drop your hands and surrender your agenda to Him. Jeannie and I have a dog. We were talking about dogs. You don't go to the Patterson's house and not talk about dogs. So we were talking about dogs this morning, right? And we were telling about our beagle. We have a beagle. I didn't want a beagle. I love dogs. We've had every kind of dog in the world. Jeannie and I were on vacation 13 years ago, and she said, "I want a beagle." And I said, "Honey, a beagle." So she called Carter and Joel's mother, our daughter, or I did. I called her, and I said, "Your mother wants a beagle." I said, with all the way, she said, I'll get one. It took her 3 weeks to find one expensive enough. And finally she got this beagle. And I want to tell you, that dog, she's my wife's dog. She loves my wife. But let me tell you something. She adores moi. She loves me. I mean, when I come home, she races to meet me, jumps up, howls. I scratch her behind the ears. She howls. She runs circles in the living room. Jeannie said one day, "Why don't you greet me like that?" I said, "Well, if you do that when I scratch you behind the ears, I could get into that." That dog absolutely loves me. But I want to tell you something. That dog does not fear me. If that dog feared me, I would not have to have a leash on her when we go walking. But she's always pulling at the leash. "Go, Master, back here. It's a dead bird. It's been here 3 days. You've missed it every time. Look, this is a perfectly good dead bird. Back here. Or there's a truck. I'll get it for you. There you go. Come on, just let me go. I'll go get it." No, but I just think how much fun, how enjoyable life would be with that dog if she would just surrender her agenda to me. What would life be like? You and I, with the days that we have here, what an incredible life this would be if we would have such a big idea of who God is that we absolutely surrender everything to Him. Now, as president of the International Mission Board, you'd expect that I would have some missional application to this. So teach us to number our days. Count out everyone as valuable. That we may, what? Have a heart. See the value in each day of surrendering to the agenda of God. So that we may apply our hearts toward wisdom. But when do we need to start that? You see, when I have been at specific junctures in my life, I have been tempted to say, okay, when I get this done and this training is over, then I'm going to serve God. Then I'm going to surrender to God. I'm going to do that when I get through college. I'm going to do that when I get through seminary. I'll do that when I get through. Then I'm going to surrender to God. I'll think about His agenda. Or maybe you get to thinking about this broken world in which we live. And you say, how can I be, you know, I don't want Jesus to come back. I don't want to hear the trumpet sound and God to find me in the library. I mean, I'd rather be out doing something that I think is important. Now, wait a minute. The call to minister is the call to train. And I can say that on behalf of International Mission Board. It's not our preference to have someone sowing into the DNA of a church planting movement something that is not true. Train. Get the best training. It's right here. It's available to you. And it is a broken world. And it's a world that needs you. It's not just the love of the Lord. Yes, that compels us, but more than that, there's something in your heart, in my heart, that says the lost. I mean, to be lost means without Christ, you enter hell forever. There are a lot of people on this globe. It took us till 1804 to reach the first billion population on this planet. Now we are adding a billion about every 12 years. 7 billion people on this globe. It would take you 37 years to count to a billion at one number a second. It means nothing in Washington, means a lot to God. Those are 7 billion people. And by the way, they're not just being born, they're dying. When I say the word second, two people have died, gone out to eternity. It's set there forever, beyond time. It's established. At the end of every day, an entire city of over 170,000 people just disappears. Think of a Google picture of the earth. Just disappears from this globe. Gone. Most of them lost. I stood at a street corner in Tokyo recently. That street corner is the busiest in the world. 50,000 people walk across that intersection every 24 hours. And in Japan, less than 1% of them would be evangelical. People are dying. Less than half of the world's population has a good chance at hearing the gospel. 1.27 billion people are very likely to die without ever hearing the name Jesus. You say, well, then I just need to pack up and go out there and just... No, why not just share it on the way home at the filling station or at the grocery store? If you're not going to do it there, you're not going to do it 7,000 miles from here. Every person you see has eternity in their heart. And while we're sitting here, the earth is spinning and revolving around the sun. What is the old saying? Time and tide wait for no man. And one of these days, God's going to ring down the curtain. You say, well, it won't be in my lifetime. It'll be for you at your death time. Never another opportunity. Never another moment. So he says to you, number your days, so that you may apply your heart to wisdom. Come before God. God, it's not my agenda, it's yours. And if you indeed are calling me in some arena of ministry, then I need to number my days while I'm in seminary. I need to soak up everything I could get. I need to reach out with my heart and pull everything I can into it. I need to be the sharpest sword that I can be. There, I can tell you this from my perspective looking back right now, I agree now with what Spurgeon said. The crown is reserved for you in heaven. Until the day that you die and I die, we have nothing to wear but a helmet. We are to be in the battle. You are to be in the battle. It's not just reserved for folks beyond you or behind me. The utility of our life increases until the day we die. Teach us, he says, to number our days, that we may apply our hearts to wisdom. Count out every day as valuable, more valuable than a diamond. In 1913, Cairo, Egypt, a young man just out of school lay dying at the age of 25, younger than some of you who are here. He was a millionaire. He had inherited vast fortunes of money. When he was 15, he made a tour of the world and came home convinced that he was to be a missionary. And his parents tried to argue him out of it. In fact, his dad told him that he'd never work for the company again. And he opened up his Bible, and in his Bible he wrote the word, no reserves, no reservation. I'm holding nothing back. I'm going forward. I'm to be a missionary. No reserves. After that trip around the world, he had decided that he was going to be a missionary to the Muslims in northern China. And so he went to Yale University, studied. And while he was there, God just used his life like a flame. I mean, drawing people. Student movement began to grow on the campus. And then he announced again, I'm headed to the mission field. And his friends and his parents and everybody else said, don't do this. This is really stupid of you to do this. And he opened his Bible. In other words, no reserves. He wrote, no retreat. At the age of 24, he got on board a ship, decided to go to Egypt first to learn about the Islamic faith. And while he was in Cairo, he contracted spinal meningitis, was gone in a month. The whole world, actually, at least his world here in the United States and the Christian world, was rocked by this. William Borden died, had such bright hopes, wonderful future, the inheritor, the heir of the great Borden fortune. How could it be? His parents lamented, his friends lamented the waste of his life, never even getting to the mission field. That'll show you how futile that is. Then his Bible arrived, along with some other belongings, back to his parents' home here in the States. When they opened the Bible, they saw that under the words, no reserve, no retreat, just days before his death, he wrote, no regret. You could say, this day is not very important. Unfortunately, along with that, you'd have to write in the back of your Bible, if you even had one, plenty of regrets, always on the retreat, filled with reservations. But it's the man or the woman who understands what it is to number your days that can say at the end of life, no reserve, no regret, no retreat. Father, teach us to number our days that we may apply, present to you as a gift, a heart that is surrendered to the agenda of our mighty, magnificent God. And I pray it in Jesus' name. Amen.
Thank you for listening to this audio from Southwestern Baptist Theological Seminary. If you want more information on our academic programs, or if you would like to support our mission, visit www.swbts.edu.